Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Janice Rae, believes that the most powerful thing in the world is a seed. In her latest book, The Seed Underground, A Growing Revolution to Save Food, she writes, quote, "Because we don't know what is sealed in a seed, since the predetermined information is invisible, it can contain any number of surprises. Everything the seed has needed to know is encoded within it, and as the world changes, so it will discover everything it yet needs to know. That's the nature of adaptation and evolution, the two most important jobs we have on this planet. So even with the climate crisis, even with peak oil and soil, even with financial collapse, there will be seeds that possess all the information they and we need, which is why I think seeds are the ultimate metaphor." Of the thousands of seed varieties available at the turn of the 20th century, 94% have been lost forever. It's hard to believe, but that's 94%. And the less biodiverse any system is, the greater potential for its collapse. So how did this happen exactly? What is at stake here, and what can we do to save the seeds we have left? Janice Rae is a poet, naturalist, seed banker, and activist. She traveled around the country meeting with gardeners and seed savers, gathering stories about the crisis in our modern food system. She also interviewed people about what they're doing to take back the power of biodiversity. Janice is the author of several books, including Ecology of a Cracker Childhood. She's on the faculty of Chatham University's MFA program, and she joins us from her home in southern Georgia. Hi, Janice. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you, Rose?
I'm good. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a beautiful book. And first off, help us wrap our heads around this number. And it's just really hard to visualize what it means when you say 94% of seeds have been lost forever.
I think it's hard to visualize, too. And I think the saddest part is the loss to our palates. You know, a lot of heirloom vegetables have been found and brought back into the marketplace and to our tables. And so we are newly tasting old varieties that were once on the verge of being lost. That's what I think of most when I try to wrap my head around it is, oh my goodness, look how many fabulous tastes we've lost. What's confusing is we haven't lost vegetables. We haven't lost tomatoes. We haven't lost kohlrabi. We've lost varieties of these things, and amazing varieties, local, place-adapted, vintage varieties.
So how did we lose so many seeds?
I think, Rose, that my family story can pretty much tell the whole story. And my grandfather was a farmer. Most all of us came from agrarians in this country. And I remember as a child his corn crib that still held corn, fields of, you know, sprawling watermelon vines. As time passed, my aunts and uncles, his children, moved away to big cities. And then by the time I was a little girl, the milk cow had been sold. The old manure fertilizer had transformed into guano and then, you know, other more nitrogen-rich forms of chemical fertilizer. It's been in my lifetime then that I've seen my grandparents' farm go from, you know, a really diverse, food-producing, place-adapted, local thing to now the fields are leased to chemical farmers who grow genetically modified soybeans subsidized by the government. This led then to a lot of seeds that my grandparents grew and saved year after year being lost, and the farmers now they must necessarily go back to the hardware store, buy the new GM variety, and plant it. So first of all, there are fewer farmers among us, down from 41% at the turn of the century to I think less than 2% right now.
Wow.
And then of us farmers, two scientific advancements have caused the loss of seeds: hybridization and the advancement of genetic technology, genetic modification.
And as you write in your book, it's really hard to believe this because those of us who are lucky enough to have access to farmers markets see beautiful vegetables. We've got an abundance here in the Bay Area. We're very lucky. And then if you go to the grocery store, even the natural food stores, the aisles are just full of so much stuff. I mean, most of it is in a package, but there's just so much. So it's hard to believe that we've lost so many varieties.
And I'm not talking about, you know, those packets and bags that you see at the grocery store. In fact, sometimes, Rose, when I'm speaking to people and they ask, you know, what can I do? Well, as Michael Pollan so beautifully writes, eat real food first. You know, learn to cook for yourself. Learn to go to the farmer's market and pick out vegetables. But what's happening to seeds is really going to take more of us looking at. It's going to take the farmer himself or herself involved. Because even organic farmers can grow hybrid seeds. A hybrid is the genetic cross of two unlike parents. Let's say you want to cross an heirloom mortgage lifter tomato with a wilt-resistant, so you want to cross this heirloom, so you've got all the flavonoids and the taste, with a new wilt-resistant variety of tomato. So these, when this cross is done, these seeds are patented and owned by seed companies. And so even organic farmers don't own their seed supply. And this is the gist, the crux of my concern and a lot of people's concern, that we understand organic. We understand that food that is grown organically is more nutritious for us. And more helpful. We also understand local, that, you know, the 1,500 miles that it takes to get the average calorie amounts up to an increase in climate change, the climate crisis. What I don't think we understand is how much of our seed supply is owned by multinational corporations and what we're going to have to do about that.
Well, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But first off, why don't we step back and talk about why seeds are so important?
Mm-hmm. Why seeds are important. All life on Earth can be traced back to seeds. Every morsel of food that you or I put in our mouths today can be traced back to a seed. Even a piece of meat. We farm, my husband and I farm here in southern Georgia, and it becomes so increasingly clear that to grow wonderful grass-fed, omega-balanced meats, that we have to have incredible pasture. Pasture can only be produced by seeds, and on and on and on. And the funny thing is, seeds are everywhere. We even eat them daily. And we almost never think about them, you know. They're these tiny little things that get stuck between your teeth. And yet, all life on Earth depends on seeds.
And what about seed biodiversity? Why is that so critical? Because you say that the less biodiverse any system is, the greater the potential for its collapse.
Yes. I think the potato famine of Ireland is probably the best example of that. The variety grown in Ireland, for the most part, was the lumper potato. 90% of families grew it. A very prolific potato. 1 acre of potato vines could feed a family for a year. And then late blight crept in and began to kill the potatoes, not while growing so much as while in storage. They rotted. And we saw what happened there. An entire diaspora of an entire people. That's my fear, that as our agriculture, with an emphasis on this word culture, as it constricts and we grow more monocultures, you know, we become more standardized and grow fewer and fewer crops on more and more acres of land. My fear, and all our fear should be, what happens should some kind of blight descend, some kind of disease? And you know, it's very funny, but there was an article in Acres USA magazine really asked the question, in what they said, you know, hasn't a blight in many ways already descended? Especially this article referred to wheat. So many of us now are gluten intolerant, and gluten intolerance plus the rise in obesity, you know, wheat belly that's been written about quite a lot, is directly tied to the proteins in the newly industrialized breeding of wheat.
Huh. Okay. I'm so glad you brought that up, because I just heard a conversation recently. People were saying, why do we have so many food allergies now?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people have issues, either, you know, acne or stomach problems or something. And in many cases, they get prescriptions, but mm-hmm. very few doctors say you should have a food allergy test. And once you have that test, you find out that you're allergic to a lot of things. And the question is, why is it that so many people are allergic now, and our grandparents really didn't deal with this?
So honestly, Rose, that's going to be a question for somebody else, and I hope a caller has the answer to that. I do place part of the blame on the kinds of food that we're breeding, that we're scientifically or genetically breeding to feed ourselves. Hmm. I'll say as well that I think that industrially produced food is more apt to cause allergies. And let's just talk a minute about genetically modified foods. We don't have great testing. You know, the FDA doesn't require independent testing of companies that want to introduce some new GM food, some new GM seed. And so I know that we do not have the entire story yet on what GM products are doing to our bodies. Many studies find that they are increasing allergens and the incidence of allergens in humans. So I think you have a great point that the increase in allergens in all of us, I think, can be directly tied to our food supply.
And then you do write about the variety of wheat, and it's amazing to think about this. You write that traditionally there were thousands of distinct wheat varieties, as many as 100,000. You talk about Ethiopian Blue Tinge. I love the names of these. Crimean Red Fife, an old Swedish variety. And now half of the wheat grown in the U.S. is just 9 varieties.
Right, and shrinking. It's just honestly, literally shrinking all the time, the diversity of the varieties. That's right. It's just so sweet to talk to you because you understand this. It's not the loss of food. You know, you walk through the grocery store, we have plenty of food. It's filling food, though. It's mm-hmm. not necessarily nutritious. And it's not necessarily going to save us should some system collapse because of the diversity. I'd like to talk about field corn, too, which I find incredibly interesting as wheat. We've had a 96% decline in field corns. In the 100 years ago, you and I could, you know, saddle up our horses and just take off riding across the country, and almost every farm at which we stopped, we would find farmers who were growing these varieties of corn that they had in their family for many, many years, sometimes generations and generations, long enough for these corns to be completely adapted to the climate, to microclimates. And that's a wonderful thing.
Well, and talk a little bit about corn. I also love, you bring in a lot of history in your book, which is fantastic. So take us back to 1932. When the first successful hybrid corn was introduced on the market.
This corn was called Golden Cross Bantam, 1932 introduced. I call that year the tipping point. The statistics from Iowa are very indicative of what was to come here. In 1935, 90% of, let's just reverse that, less than 10% of Iowa corn was hybridized. And 4 years later, by 39, more than 90% of it was. So what you get is an entire sea change in 4 short years. It's very difficult to blame farmers. Hybrids increase productivity. They have a trait called hybrid vigor. They are also, hybrids are bred to be, more adaptable to a wider range of conditions. And farmers, this Golden Cross Bantam also was resistant to a bacterial, a virus that had affected farmers dramatically. Stewart's bacterial wilt. And suddenly, farmers could make a real living growing corn, which was incredible. I'm not faulting them. What they had no idea of, and what many of us today have no idea of, is how much diversity we're losing when we simply replace agriculture with agribusiness.
We're speaking with Janice Ray about her new book, The Seed Underground, A Growing Revolution to Save Food. And again, I have to repeat this because it's hard to wrap your arms around. It's hard to believe, but 94% of our seeds have been lost forever. 94% of seed varieties. And the less biodiverse any system is, the greater the potential for its collapse. But Janice does say there are steps we can take to save what's left, and we'll spend a lot of time talking about that. And we'd love to hear from you. If you save seeds, how do you do it? How do you think? What steps do you think we should take to save seeds? If you're a gardener, what are your thoughts on the issue of seed biodiversity and its importance? How do you talk about this to people to get people to really care about it? If you grew up on or near a farm, what is your connection to seeds now compared to back then? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Janice traveled around the country meeting with gardeners and seed savers to talk about this crisis and to also talk about what we can do to take back the power of biodiversity. So if you have any questions about what she found, we'd love to hear from you. What do we lose when we lose seeds and seed varieties? 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Janice, why don't you talk a little bit about the corporations and their role in this. You say something, another thing about small farmers and the power they really have. You write, a diversified small farmer who saves her own seeds is not only of no use to a corporation, but a threat. What do you mean by that exactly?
Well, the purpose of corporations is not to benefit humanity in the long run, to elevate the magnanimity of human existence. Corporations have one goal, and that is to make more and more money. And one of the ways that they have taken to doing it is to claim what I consider the commons, you know, water, in some cases air. I believe that seeds, you know, seeds being the essence of the food supply and the basis for the future of life on this planet, I believe seeds to be a part of the commons and that they should not be owned. I am not necessarily in favor of a corporation being able to patent, especially, you know, some seed that's been around forever, like wild rice, and which is exactly what is happening. In general, Rose, as we switch from small, diversified, you know, place-adapted farms to more and more multinational corporations and large monoculture chemical farms, it was a switch from the small to the large, of course, the local to the global, but also from the storied to the acultural, and then consequently from purity, although that's, you know, a little debatable, but to more and more toxification. And then the last thing I want to mention is from independence to victimization. So when we're in charge of our seed supply, when we have sovereignty, then we have sovereignty over our futures. And I've long been a person who advocated for justice and for the rights of people. And in this case, part of what I'm advocating for is the right of people to have a supply of food for as long as we exist on the planet.
Well, and speaking of corporations, there was a very important case that just began yesterday. Opening arguments were underway in a legal battle between Monsanto and DuPont over Monsanto's control of a popular seed technology worth billions of dollars. We're talking about a lucrative seed technology that makes soybeans, corn, and other crops. Have you been following this case?
You know, not enough, but I'm so interested in it. So Please tell me more.
Well, I'm reading this Reuters story, and according to this piece, it says this trial is expected to last about 3 months, or I'm sorry, 3 weeks. And Monsanto is arguing that DuPont, through its Pioneer Hybrid International unit, has violated a 2002 licensing agreement giving DuPont the right to use Monsanto's glyphosate-tolerant Roundup-ready soybean trait. And DuPont is countering that Monsanto fraudulently obtained the patent.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
So what does this mean exactly?
Okay, so glyphosate, you know, did you just say it's Roundup?
Right.
Okay, so what happened was that some of the first seeds to be patented were Roundup-ready seeds. Let me just, are you okay? If you don't mind, I'm going to take a minute and explain Roundup.
No, please. That's very important.
Yes. Traditionally, a farmer who decided to use chemicals would go into a field and spray the field with chemicals that would kill an herbicide that would kill all the weeds, and then come along and plant the crop that he or she wanted to plant. There would then be no more herbicide use on the field. There would be, you know, weeding by harrow or by hand or whatever. With the invention of Roundup Ready, that means the farmer could plant these soybeans, which in essence wore raincoats that prevented the herbicide from killing the soybean, the germinated soybeans. All the other weeds would be killed. So this allowed farmers to, instead of using tractors to kill weeds in their fields, they could keep spraying this chemical, Roundup, glyphosate. So I don't know the particulars of what's happening between these two companies. I will tell you that three companies control half the seed market globally, and DuPont is one of them, and they're a U.S. company, Monsanto, and then Syngenta from Switzerland. So internal bickering about who I sound a little ironic, don't I, about who can make more money than the other.
Well, no, I mean, we were almost kind of laughing when we saw this headline, just that the Monsanto and DuPont are in court. In 2009, Monsanto sued DuPont for what it said was unauthorized use of the Roundup Ready herbicide. So, so that's where this stems from.
Okay.
What else do we need to know? Actually, we're going to go to break quickly, but I want to talk after break about what we need to know about these corporations and what role they play with seeds, and how you see this playing out now that there's so much awareness about a corporation like Monsanto. We hear regularly of farmers in India committing suicide, for example, and there's just massive activism on the ground in India when it comes to trying to preserve seeds. So we'll talk about that after the break. And today we're talking with Janice Ray. She's author of the new book, The Seed Underground, A Growing Revolution to Save Food. And Janice writes about the power. She believes that the most powerful thing in the world is a seed. 94% of seed varieties have been lost forever. But she says there is hope. There's a lot we can do to save what's left. So if you have any comments or questions about what it will take to save seeds, what is your relationship with seeds, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. And why is this important? You can leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco. Our email newsletter is a great way to keep up to date with local public radio, as well as find out the latest developments in non-commercial media. And we won't send you tons of emails, but every week or two you'll get an email from us with updates on KALW programming and public events, as well as the occasional free ticket offer. It's easy to sign up. Just click on the e-newsletter link on the homepage of KALW.org. And thank you for listening to and supporting KALW, San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter, which we are completely redoing. We'll be sending you a new newsletter soon at yourcallradio.org, and you can find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about what happens when we don't get enough sleep. According to the National Sleep Foundation, at least 40 million Americans suffer from sleep disorders. So how much sleep do you need? How much do you get? And what effect does sleep have on your overall well-being? Is sleep deprivation becoming a public health issue? That's tomorrow, and then on Friday, it's our media roundtable. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the importance of seed biodiversity. We have lost 94% of seed varieties, which means they are gone forever. The less biodiverse any system is, the greater the potential for its collapse. But today's guest, Janice Ray, believes that there is hope. There's a lot we can do to save what is left, and it's very important to save what is left. We've got about 6% left. And Janice is out with a new book about these issues called The Seed Underground, A Growing Revolution to Save Food. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts on this issue? What is your relationship with seeds? If you garden, how do you make sense of this issue? And why do you think, or what can we do to save seeds? If you have any questions about what Janice found in her travels or questions about what role the multinationals play, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Janice Ray is a poet, naturalist, seed banker, and activist, and she's on the faculty of Chatham University's MFA program. And let's hear from Jackie in Santa Cruz. Hi, Jackie. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's good that you're doing this. I just wanted to bring up a couple of things from farmers who have loans with the bank, certainly all across the Midwest, are told by the financial institution what chemicals in what concentrations at what intervals they must apply to their crops in order to get the loans to do their business each year. So any kind of solution, it goes right back to our big banks and has to be worked out there. And you'd also better look really closely at how the government is affecting this, because in the last century, when my folks ran a hybrid seed corn company, it had a make or break effect on farmers.
Oh, wait, so the banks are actually telling the farmers what?
In order to get your every year, you know, you get your crop,
right?
But then for the next year, in order to buy your seed and your fertilizer, et cetera, they've all got it into this, you know, you've got to pay for all this stuff because you don't have animals on the farm to produce the fertilizer, et cetera. So in order to get your loan, you're commonly given a prescription of, we will give you this money only if you agree that you're buying so much of this chemical and applying it in this concentration at these intervals during the planting and during the whole year.
Janice, are you aware of this?
No, I wasn't. Jackie, I'm so glad you called and so interested in this. And I want to ask you a question in a minute about what seeds your family produce. But let me say this: you bring up an amazing, a crucially important point, which is this revolving door between government and industry, yeah. And it's the battle that we're involved in right now with the Farm Bill. We have, you know, for the past maybe three decades, been really pushing the government to give more and more research money to organic research, to fund more organic farmers. So if you are an organic farmer, you're definitely not told what to plant. But you're exactly right that the government and multinationals go hand in hand, which requires of us an even greater grassroots resistance to that dynamic.
You know, it's interesting. I'm glad you brought this up because the non-GMO project just put a graphic together of crossover between Monsanto executives and the federal government. So, for example, Tom Vilsack, this is just one example. President Obama's Secretary of Agriculture used to be a Monsanto executive. And in this graphic, they've got about 15 names of Monsanto execs who are now working for the federal government.
Wow. That's exactly right. You know, on one hand, we can get really depressed about those figures, but on the other hand, I just see tremendous opportunity. And when I look at the resistance on the part of farmers, on the part of eaters, on the part of seed bankers all across this country and the world, that is the exciting part. And Rose, I wanted to interject here a little thing about hope. In the news daily, we get lots of bad news. You know, there's another line of storms have come through, and this many people have died in Alabama. And, you know, these storms have hit Appalachian. And it was in the midst of a lot of cavernous hopelessness, I call it, that I began to see that the most hopeful things happening around us, one of the most hopeful things were the people who were returning to sovereignty over their food, which also meant they were increasing the quality of their life. They were creating lives that made sense. They were refusing to take part in a life that corporations and government demanded of us. And that hopefulness is what drove me to write the book and drives me to love this topic more and more all the time.
That reminds me of Sylvia Davitz, the radical gardener that you met, who is basically saying that her form of resistance is to just make a broken system seem irrelevant.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and that's why I put Sylvia's, there's a paragraph about Sylvia at the very beginning of the book, because, you know, I too was resisting. You know, I was marching, and I was getting arrested for climate change, and on and on and on. And then, you know, I just thought, if there's a way that I can be part of the new system, the new land-based gentry that includes us peasants, then that's what I want to do.
Well, thank you for calling in, Jackie. Let's hear next from Tom in Oakland. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Great show. It's such a crucial topic. And this is an obvious question, but since it's so well known that diversity is crucial to survival, why do these corporations just ignore the facts? It's sort of self-destructive, isn't it, for the whole world?
So what do you mean, Tom? Explain
that. Well, they
that.
Know that, okay, you were stating earlier that diversity in agriculture is so crucial to the survival of a system because without it, things break down.
Mm-hmm.
And so companies like Monsanto are responsible for limiting the amount of seeds, which ultimately is very self-destructive to humankind.
Yes, I've got you. It's never been, to my knowledge, corporations care very much less about the bottom line in the present and not the future of life on Earth. And I don't mean to be so blunt about that, but I don't think that really enters the corporate imagination.
All right. Well, thank you, Tom, for calling in. I'm sure people ask themselves this question on a regular basis. Now, I'd like to welcome Matthew Dillon to the show. Matthew is director of Seed Matters, an initiative of the Clif Bar Family Foundation to improve organic seed systems. It was established in 2009, and it's funded more than a dozen organic seed research and education projects. And Matthew joins us from Emeryville. Hi, Matthew. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rose. It's
great to have you. So now let's talk, really. We've been talking with Janice Ray about what we're facing, about the fact that we've lost 94% of seed varieties. Let's talk about what's actually happening on the ground to preserve what we have left. So tell us a little bit about Seed Matters and what you're doing to preserve what's left.
You bet. I think it's important for us, first of all, to remember that we're part of an ongoing process of over 10,000 years of human-plant interaction, of this domesticating, diversifying, and adapting new crops to our ever-changing needs, changing because of climate changes, population pressures, and so on. So in that ongoing story that we're a part of with these plants, there is some scary news here that's happened in the last 50, 60, 100 years, as you all have talked about. But there's also a lot of really good work going on. And from the Seed Matters perspective, we're focused on trying to restore and reinvigorate the public and regional seed systems that helped create this genetic diversity and steward this genetic diversity in the first place. And those would include the work of gardeners, that you've all talked about, as well as farmers who were our first real innovators when it came to seed breeding and seed stewardship. Also our land-grant universities, our public breeding programs, which have held a historically important role in adapting and creating new genetic diversity for regional agriculture, and regional seed companies that used to hold that role in a more prominent place before the concentration and patenting and control of seed that you've mentioned today. So we fund the very first fellowships in organic plant breeding. We fund four fellowships in organic plant breeding. We're doing breeding of quinoa, for example, here in the United States, in organic systems, sweet corn, vegetables, barley and wheat. We fund grants that are go directly to organic farmers to do breeding work in the field. And we work with nonprofit partners like Organic Seed Alliance to train farmers to bring back those seed skills that have been lost. And the loss of those seed skills is as scary, certainly, as the loss of the diversity of varieties themselves. Because without those skills, we can neither steward varieties nor can we create the new diversity we need to have it in hand to address issues like climate change and climate variability. So we have kind of an integrated program that works with the farmers, works with the public universities. We have a new program that will be coming out this fall called Community Seed Toolkits that provides individuals with the ability to start their own seed swaps, their own community seed libraries and seed banks, their own community seed gardens. So we try to look at it from this integrated, holistic perspective. And the Clif Bar Family Foundation and its other corporate partners, actually, from the organic food industry, have now raised well over $1.2 million to fund this work and to begin to create some positive news stories and new vision for how we can take back our seed system.
And Matthew, how do you get people to care about this issue and to really take action on this issue? I mean, the food is getting so much more attention these days and local, but there also seems to be a disconnect when you look at where food comes from.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's really in our DNA. As I said, this is a co-evolutionary process of humans and plants interacting in relationship for really almost 12,000 years. And most people, once they've grown their own food in a small garden area, they get the sense of wanting to see a plant go through its full life cycle, and they understand the importance of seed. It's something that's really ingrained within us. So when you're talking about something as primal as food, and seed is that first link in the food production process, people just tend to get it when you start to talk to them about it. You tell them the stories, you clue them into the potential of seed to continue to improve the quality. You know, every seed we plant has the potential for either improving or creating a loss of quality in the food we eat and in the impacts of that food on the environment. It either impacts positively or negatively the ecological footprint, the nutritional value, the overall quality of the food we eat. And when you talk to people at that level and they realize the concrete positive impacts of having better seed systems, they want to get involved. They want to learn how to save seed. They want to promote farmers and help farmers to breed their own seed and care for their own seed. And they want our public universities to do their jobs, to go back to breeding public seed for the public good, for that commons that you all talked about earlier. And we're finding a lot of public researchers, plant breeders, who want to get back involved in breeding for regional agriculture, local agriculture. The university professors are very excited about these fellowships and these programs.
And Janice, what are your thoughts on efforts like Seed Matters? And did you find similar projects across the country?
Oh, not so much similar. I'm just so happy about Seed Matters and the Clif Bar Foundation as well. And Matthew, you speak so eloquently. Thank you so much. And I thought maybe I should explain what happened with public universities, public breeding systems at public universities, is that
because grant money declined, they were forced to breed new varieties and then sell the patents to seed companies. And so we had people who were our people working for us for the betterment of our citizenry suddenly on the sides of big companies, mostly corporations, selling seeds that should have been ours in the public domain to companies and us only being able to buy them from them. So, Rose, what was the question you asked me?
Oh, I just wondered what your thoughts were about efforts like Seed Matters.
Definitely. Amazing work. Yes.
All right. Well, Matthew, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rose.
Matt Dillon is director of Seed Matters. That's an initiative of the Clif Bar Family Foundation to improve organic seed systems, and they're funding organic seed research and education projects. And you can find more information about it at yourcallradio.org. And we're speaking today with Janice Ray about her new book, The Seed Underground, A Growing Revolution to Save Seeds. And we're talking about what we can do to save the seeds that we have left, the seed varieties that are still available. And if you'd like to join us, we've got about 10 minutes left. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What is at stake here? What can we do to save the seeds we have left? What do seeds mean to you? If you've got any stories, if you're a gardener, a farmer, if you work in biotech, what are your thoughts on this issue? 866-798-8255. And let's hear from Patrick O'Connor, who's coordinator of the Bay Area Seed Interchange Library, which is a seed borrowing library at the Ecology Center in Berkeley. Hi, Patrick. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So talk a little bit about the library.
The library is a resource. We have drawers with seeds that are totally open access, so anyone can take seeds or bring seeds in. And the idea is that you check out seeds, grow them out, and return the next generation of seeds.
Ah. And how many people use this?
Hundreds. I don't have solid numbers right now.
So basically, you've got a library of vegetable, herb, and flower seeds, and the public can come in, grab some, plant them, and then bring seeds back.
Yes.
Oh, that's great. So how do you talk to the public about this issue? How do you get people to care about this issue?
While we do talk about, larger issues of genetic erosion, but we also just engage with people on their love for gardening. I mean, often people will find, one or a handful of crops that they really love, and those will be the people who save and share those seeds with the library. So, and we have a seed swap. We've had our 13th annual seed swap this year, and so that's one of our main events. It's really festive. It's kind of like a potluck for seeds. We have tables with all the different, vegetable plant families, and we have to put on workshops.
Great. And so can anyone just walk in and grab some seeds? How does the program work?
Yeah, well, you just register and you sign in, seeds and you check them out. It's pretty self-serve. It's just a volunteer organization, and so it's a pretty light organizational model, and it's been replicated all around the country in different ways. Like we're based out of a nonprofit, but Hayes Valley Farm has one, mm-hmm. and their community farm, and public libraries especially. There's been a lot of new seed libraries.
Great. Well, it's a great service. Thank you so much for calling in. That is Patrick O'Connor. He is coordinator of the Bay Area Seed Interchange Library. It's a seed borrowing library at the Ecology Center in Berkeley. And you can find a link at yourcallradio.org. And Janice, as you said, there are so many exciting things going on around the country. What else did you find during your travels that made you hopeful?
I found entire communities banding together to lobby for the right to produce and eat the food that they of their own choosing, especially in Maine. Sedgwick, Blue Hill, there are five small towns in Maine, were passing local food and community self-governance ordinances. Very, very exciting stuff. They're making a stand for their fundamental rights to choose food. I also found I love these entire states like Vermont and California working to make sure that GM foods are labeled, mm-hmm. which I think is very absolutely necessary.
We have a huge, we're going to be voting on that in November, and all eyes are on California right now.
I know. My eyes are on you all, too. So don't let me down, okay, California?
Well, you bet that the multinationals are going to, or are already spending a lot of money on this initiative.
Yes, exactly. The third thing, Rose, is, I mean, I love this idea of libraries like Patrick just talked about. But just the idea of a seed bank, and not a seed bank, you know, in Svalbard, in Norway, at what we call the Doomsday Vault. The people around the world, governments have stored just thousands upon thousands of varieties of seed in this place located in a mountain, frozen, where in no matter what disaster may befall us, we hope that seeds will continue. But a seed only has a certain lifespan, like all of us. It has a viability for a certain number of years. So the best seed banks are the ones that are in gardens, that are in situ, that are allowed to, as they grow out and seeds are saved and those are planted and they grow out, that are allowed to adapt to changing conditions. And those seed banks are incredibly exciting. They're popping up all over this country. And that means that folklorists, we'll call them, are going out, roaming the countryside, finding local varieties of things and bringing them back into these banks and keeping them in circulation. But don't you love that metaphor of books in circulation and seeds in circulation? Lovely.
Oh, yeah. Well, we actually have a question from Armand about the seed bank in the Arctic. What are your thoughts on this? And do you think that a small portion of these seeds will be released to farmers to reintroduce them?
Well, I don't know, actually, Rose. They may be there just forever until there's some kind of catastrophe. And you know, let's just say that some horrible blight descended and we in South Georgia lost all of our watermelon varieties, and we would all hope that the varieties at Svalbard would be made available to our plant researchers and scientists, so that we could come up with some new blight-resistant varieties of watermelon. So I have hope that, you know, by the time that blight descended, that the seeds would still be viable there. I just still, again, believe that the best seed banks are gardens, living seed banks. That, you know, it's like the metaphor is you can lock your doors and buy guns and put them under your pillow, have a conscript of larger and larger military. But this other school of thought believes that we're safer when we're out in the world, interacting with each other and attempting to understand the world and each other. And I believe seeds are the same.
And we just have a couple more minutes, but I wanted to welcome Jim Gerritsen to the show. Jim's an organic seed farmer with Wood Prairie Farm in northern Maine. And Jim is president of the Organic Seed Growers, which filed a lawsuit against Monsanto this year on behalf of 60 family farmers, seed businesses, and organic agricultural organizations challenging Monsanto's patents on genetically modified seed. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. Unfortunately, we only have a couple of minutes left, but can you give us an update on this case, which now has 83 plaintiffs and represents over 270,000 farmers in the U.S. and Canada?
Yes. The case was originally filed in March of 2011, and Monsanto very quickly pursued a strategy of trying to, with pretrial efforts, get the case dismissed so that they would not have to face the family farmers in court. We went through exchange of briefs. We had an oral argument in New York City. And then the judge midwinter, dismissed the case. And last week we filed our appeal to the Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., appealing the dismissal of the case. In our brief, we cited four reversible errors that the judge had committed, each of which are self-standing and will allow the court of appellate of the appellate court justices to turn around her dismissal and to send this case back to trial.
So it's been a long process. And Jim, because we only have a couple minutes, 1 minute left, actually, what role are farmers playing right now to preserve the seeds we have left?
Well, as your previous commenter made the point, the best way to preserve seed is living seed. And many of the organic farmers in the country plant open-pollinated varieties, which allow them to select and adapt for regional adaptation, superior strains within a given variety. That's what we do on our farm. Many organic farmers do that. And that's really the best way of not only ensuring survivability of seed, but also improvement of seed, so that seed that is grown under organic conditions that demonstrate superior capability, that is what is saved, so that every generation is actually better. So we're actually, with this living seed, we're making the seed better. And then some of us that are in the seed business, we're making that seed available to other organic farmers and other organic gardeners that they can then plant in their gardens, and they can conduct the same process of from selection. They can get varieties that are specifically adapted to their climate and their situation.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We've got a few emails from small gardeners who want tips on seed saving. We'll find a couple of links and put those at yourcallradio.org. Jim Gerritsen is an organic seed farmer with Wood Prairie Farm in Northern Maine, and Janice Ray is author of The Seed Underground, A Growing Revolution to Save Food. Thank you all for joining us, and thank you so much, Janice, for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. What happens when you don't get enough sleep? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about how sleep affects our mental and physical health. According to the National Sleep Foundation, at least 40 million Americans suffer from sleep disorders. So how much sleep do you need? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What effect does sleep have on our well-being? And is sleep deprivation becoming a public health issue? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.